Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you'd like to talk with Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our calls, what are the topics we'll be talking over this time?
Yes, we'll be talking about tinnitus, ringing in the ears, how you might have another way to handle it. Lots and lots of Americans suffer from ringing in their ears, and this is a new treatment, an alternative treatment that may work.
Okay.
And low-sodium diets, do they pose a risk by actually producing too much potassium? Very interesting article that was published in the British Medical Journal.
Okay, later on, what's our recipe?
Asparagus salad with crab. I happen to love asparagus. I happen to love crab. I happen to love this recipe. You will love it too.
Okay, that's coming up. Again, 800-462-7413 if you'd like to question the doc. To the phones we go, Zorba and our first caller, a listener in Sandpoint, Idaho. Hi.
Hey, hello. How you doing, Tom? Dr.
Fine.
Zorba?
Thanks. How can we help you?
Hey, in my hand I am holding a toe, my big toe on the left foot, and it has an ingrown toenail, at least that's what I hear they're called. It's been bothering me for months, and I would really like to know how to deal with it.
Are you going to keep on holding that toe during the whole conversation?
during the entire conversation, I am not letting go of this thing.
You know what I think we have to do on the radio now? What we have to do is also take radio and move it into some video Skype so we can all actually look at the toe while he's actually
Could you hold
toe.
Your toe during a whole conversation?
I don't really
he's
know if
pretty
I
nimble.
Could. That's right. He is nimble holding his toe. So how long have you had this puppy? I don't mean your toe, but I mean the ingrown
part. You know, it's been a couple of months.
Do you have trauma to the toe? Do you play any sports?
No. The only thing is I have been wearing – I've been doing a lot of work where I have been wearing heavy boots with extra thick socks.
Because that's – I mean, and that fits exactly with what my question was. Because one of the causes of an ingrown toenail, we often see it in athletes, often teenage boys and girls who are out there on the soccer field or on the baseball field or in football in cleats. And because it's trauma, it's the trauma of your toe and your nail at the end of the shoe bouncing around. So first of all, number one is to prevent it from happening in the future. You don't want to have as much, if you will, tightness within your shoe as you have. In other words, that's a critical issue that you got to address. So that's the first thing I would do is think about that in the future. No double socking when it comes to those boots. An ingrown toenail is a misnomer. It's not really an ingrown toenail. It's an overgrowth of the skin around the nail. Mm. The nail has been in the same spot at all, but what happens is the trauma then produces trauma to the skin that's around the nail, and then it begins to puff up and puff up and puff up. And so what you actually have to deal with is the skin. The easy way, the simple way that works some of the time, the conservative treatment of an ingrown toenail is to soak your foot in something like Epsom salts. You go to the store, you purchase Epsom salts. It explains right in the bottle what a soak will be like, and you soak your foot. The other thing is trying to put a little bit of cotton or wool. They're cotton balls, but you can buy wool cotton balls. They're not made of cotton at all. They're right. Made of wool. And you put them under the nail very, very carefully with a little tweezers, because what you want to do is you want to try to keep that part of the nail and the skin from touching each other. That's what's producing it. And when that fails, frankly, sometimes you have to have the nail removed, and it's a little bit painful. Well, I've never had it removed, so maybe it's a lot painful, but you freeze it. And sometimes you have to remove it because then it takes about 6 months for the nail to grow back and the skin has a chance.
But won't you have the same problem once the nail grows back?
Well, not unless he continues to double sock on his shoe. You know, and that's the issue if you're playing soccer, is that often soccer players do get it, you know, they have it recurrently, but he's not a soccer player. What do you do for a living?
Well, I'm semi-retired, but I do aerial photography with a radio control airplane.
Hmm. Oh, wait, aerial photography with radio controlled airplanes. So you're on the ground and
I'm on the ground
and the plane is up above and
yeah.
Wow,
what is this, a little model plane or a real plane?
Yeah, it's a little model plane.
A little model plane? How did you get into that? I mean, I know this is off topic, but hey, I'm in my office.
Well,
I often go off topic in my office.
I just happened to see one in a toy catalog. My wife got it for me at Christmas, and it got me started. And I've always done photo documentation, and off it went. And now I've got pictures all over the newspaper, and I'm shooting for a major highway project in town.
Oh, my goodness. That is fascinating. Yeah. That is fascinating. Well, as long as you don't use your feet on the controls, it's going to be okay.
That's what works. I keep my feet on the ground.
That's it. You got it. Keep your feet on the ground. Soak it. Put the cotton or the wool in between. And if you need further advice, give us a call. And hopefully you won't have to have the nail removed. Thank you for your call.
Tom, Dr. Zorba, thank you.
You can let go of your toe now.
Okay.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413. It's toll-free, 1-800-462-7413. To Gatlinburg, Tennessee we go now, Zorba. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Let's see. I'm a 49-year-old artist and sculptor. I work about 3 to 5 hours a day with a clay called polymer clay. Mm-hmm. And for about a year now, I've been waking up almost daily with these very tingly, numb hands and fingers. It's not really like the pins and needles tingly, but still it can be painful and annoying. Luckily, the pain goes away by the time I leave for work, and I don't have any pain during the day. I also spend about 5 hours on the computer a day, and I use only one hand with the mouse, but it seems to be happening in both hands, so I'm a bit bewildered. And I went to this clinic. They ruled out carpal tunnel, and I'm a guitar player, so I really don't want to lose my hands.
Oh, my goodness.
Of course. Well, you're right. No one actually wants to lose their hands.
Well, but anyone
says, gee, get rid of these hands. Yeah. I'm already
ready to go.
But
if it were for you or me,
it would be a different issue.
We could still do I could still do my job.
See, right. We don't need our hands.
I don't need hands.
But I use my hands to talk, Tom. Don't you see I'm always using my hands? I mean, my hands are not simply down here, please. It's an important part. I want to talk about this carpal tunnel. Yeah. How did they rule out carpal tunnel syndrome? Did they do something called an EMG?
They had me put my hands, the palms of my hands together and press.
Uh-huh, okay.
Really hard.
The way you diagnose carpal tunnel syndrome is by something called an EMG. An EMG is where you're actually looking at the electrical impulses that are going down in your hands. And most importantly about the EMG, which is done by a neurologist, is that it diagnoses not just carpal tunnel syndrome, but some people have problems with their elbows, higher up in their shoulder, anywhere along the arm. And it sounds to me like this is something that may be neurological in nature. And I think you really need an EMG in order to actually diagnose it. That would be my recommendation.
Okay.
So, you know, it's very important. I'll tell you why you've got to also do this. Sometimes carpal tunnel syndrome can go too far, or the ulnar nerve, which is the crazy bone in our elbow, which is obviously not a bone but a nerve, can also be compressed and go too far. And often if you allow this nerve to breathe, it doesn't really breathe, but you're not putting pressure on it. But if you allow the nerve to have a little bit of space, you can get rid of the symptoms completely. So the clinical diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome, which they did in the office, mm-hmm. is only so. The EMG is really definitive along with the actual symptoms. So get an EMG, because then you'll find out what sort of surgical procedure or injection you may need.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Yep, thanks. We appreciate the call. 1-800-462-7413, toll free.
You know, it's like you said, Tom, some of us use our hands, we all use our hands, but for some of us, the fine motor control of playing a guitar or working as an artist,
exactly.
Yeah, you notice every little change in your fingers and your hands, and some people are really much more affected in their job by this than other people.
So, Zorba, you say there's some new research on help with tinnitus or tinnitus.
Yes, that's right. Tinnitus or tinnitus. Which way is it pronounced? Well, the grammar police will give us the proper answer, but in fact, in my office, some people say tinnitus, some people say tinnitus, but everybody says, I have ringing in my ears.
Yeah, right.
So that's what it is. And the problem is we don't have a good treatment for this. This is ultimately due to damage that has occurred to the cochlea, which is really the organ of Corti, which is the organ within our ear that actually is our ability to actually appreciate sound. And when the little hairs get destroyed by loud noise, by sudden pressure, by, we'll say, gunshots or bombs or things like that, we have this chronic ringing. And the problem is it gets worse over time.
Mm-hmm.
and for many, many people, and it becomes very disturbing. So if it's very disturbing, the traditional treatment has been white noise. And white noise is you turn on your radio, and you don't turn it on to public radio, but in between the stations, and it makes that kind of garbled noise if you still have a radio to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Or you get a white noise generator, or you listen to music when you're going to sleep, or you listen to the sounds mm-hmm. of the ocean and so mm-hmm. on. And the idea is that this will keep your mind focused on something else.
Right.
But there is a new treatment, which is to keep your mind focused on it, and it's mindfulness meditation. And this was a study that looked at mindfulness meditation where people actually focused on the ringing in the ears, mm-hmm. and they focused in such a way that they were able to look at it, live with it, and control it. So
right.
instead of trying to ignore it, they did exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. They focused on it, and they said, you know, in your mind, I have ringing in the ears. This is part of my body, and I can ignore it.
Meditative process.
Exactly, meditative process. Now, I found this, when I read this article, I found it very interesting that you're meditating on the noise so that you can basically discount it, but you know it's there. And it reminded me of something that happened in my office just the other day. I had a mother in there with three young kids, mm-hmm. and we have four kids in our family, and we had three in 30 months. So, you know, for a long time, when our children were young, we were used to that noise and mm-hmm. that chaos. And I remember we'd walk into a house. I mean, we were used to it because three kids and they're noisy, and you're listening to the noise, but you're ignoring the noise. You're meditating on the noise because you want to know whether or not there's bad noise. Do you mm-hmm. have to attend to something, mm-hmm. or is it just sort of the chaos of children? And I remember going into houses where people had one child,
yeah.
and we'd kind of roll into the house, and the noise level would go up by, you know, 50 or 60 decibels. And when we left, you could just see the relief in the house of our friends going, oh, my goodness, I'm so glad. We love them, but it was so noisy when they came in because they weren't used to the noise.
Yeah.
We're used to the noise, so we could listen and ignore the noise. This is kind of similar with ringing in the ears. The noise is there. Mm-hmm. Don't ignore it. Attend to it. Mm-hmm. And then once you attend to it and know it's there, you can then ignore it.
So if I go to a house with noisy kids and friends,
right.
I can
yes.
just focus on that. Noisy, noisy, noisy. Part of me. I own this noise. And it won't
that's,
bother me.
That's right. You've got it, Tom. That's exactly what you've got. Very good. Very good. That's it. That, ringing in the ears, noisy children, all yeah. the same. You got it.
1-800-462-7413. Toll free. 1-800-462-7413. Belleville, Illinois listener now. Hi.
Hello.
How
Thank
can
you
we
for
help?
Taking my call. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you very much. How can we help?
Well, I'm always on the quest for a healthier lifestyle, and so this summer I picked up a book. I haven't finished reading it yet, but it's called The China Study by Dr. Campbell, and basically promotes a vegan lifestyle, suggesting that animal-based proteins lead to all sorts of maladies and cancers and all sorts of bad things, and is promoting a plant-based diet. And he shows really compelling research results that are hard to refute. I did look on the internet, and you find all sorts of people who do try to counter his research and his tactics, but I was wanting to get your thoughts on that.
Right. Well, first of all, let's look at vegetarianism as an issue. Looking at vegetarianism and sort of the periphery of vegetarianism, which is veganism, you know, that, you know, no animal-based proteins at all, you know, which is a subgroup of that.
Right.
This is really nothing new. There have been books on it, on
right.
vegetarianism, that have started being published that date back really to the early 1700s and the importance of a vegetarian diet. And you always have these two sides.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at, if we look at the Atkins diet as an example of non-vegetarianism,
right.
That started in England back in the 1800s when they were discussing the mutton-bacon diet, and the way to health was by eating mutton and bacon. And so you have people who are always proffering diets, and I think discussing diets is good for business. I think it's good for the book business.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's good for all kinds of businesses. You know, where's the science behind it? I'm a science-based person, and, you know, and where's the, you know, where's the riffraff? Where's the junk? So first of all, we know that vegetarianism is really, really good. We know that vegetarians tend to have less blood pressure, they have less heart disease, they have less stroke. Mm-hmm. Why? They don't have as much animal fat. Mm-hmm. So we know plant-based foods are really quite good. And then the subgroup of vegetarianism, veganism, you know, is that as good? Well, we know that dairy has some very useful things for us. Can you get by without it? Absolutely. To me, it's really a style issue when we look at vegetarianism or veganism. If you want to go to that issue of becoming a vegan versus a vegetarian, it's style. And that's the same as do I like red or do I like blue or do I like yellow? I don't think there's any scientific evidence as long as you get that. But your question is, are animal proteins the proteins, not the fat, bad for you? I don't think there's any evidence at all. I think that's riffraff, junk, quackery. I don't think there's any evidence at all that eating animal-based proteins are what, you know, are what's causing cancer. One of the main things that we have is we're living longer, so there's more cancer. We know that age is the biggest risk factor for cancer. The older you get, the more likely you are to get cancer. And nobody knows why. You know, is it programmed in the genes so that we'll expire and leave young people to be actually to take our place and reproduce? From a Darwinian point of view, it makes a lot of sense. We ought to have cancer and heart disease, so we're out of here so that the limited resources will feed young people who can have children. So Darwinian-wise, that's why we have cancer. It makes a lot of sense. But I don't think there's any evidence that animal proteins cause this. We don't know what causes cancer. You know, I mean, he could be right, but maybe cancer is caused by radiation from the sun. Maybe it's, you know, due to magnetic changes in the magnetic fields. Maybe it's due, you know, to Mother Earth, you know, whispering something in the ether. I don't think anyone really knows what this is, except for the most credible evidence of what causes cancer at this time, in that it may be viral. We now know that there are viral cancers. We know that HIV is associated with Kaposi sarcoma. We know that cervical cancer is associated. It's an STD from human papillomavirus. We know there's several forms of lymphoma that are also caused by viruses. I think the most credible evidence for cancer is it comes from a virus.
Well, and I try to avoid living my life in fear, because for every food they say is good for you, you can read in some other magazine that there's something wrong with it, or that it does some damage. But, okay, so moderation is the key.
Moderation is the key. And you hit the other key is, don't live your life in fear. You want to enjoy life. And to me, enjoying life means living in moderation. But, once again, it's a style issue. For other people, enjoying life means following a very strict diet because that gives them joy. So thanks for your call. And really, thanks for bringing this up. Great topic.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Before we break, Zorba, time for another installment of Traveling Tips from Zorba. Today's question comes to us from Carolyn in Cross Plains, Wisconsin, who's looking for additional cruise ship suggestions from you. She writes, "You've dealt with cruise ships and motion sickness. What about cruise ships and noroviruses? What are important things to do to avoid them outside of good hand washing, keeping hands away from your face, avoiding common environmental surfaces, and avoiding people in general?"
Well, that's, you know, the norovirus is this, which is probably a virus. It's an agent, and it appears to be a virus, but we call it an agent, that occurs on cruise ships and makes everybody sick, you know.
It's really an awful thing.
Oh,
you save up your money, take a nice cruise, and a day or two in, you're sick for the rest of the cruise.
Well, and sometimes they actually have to come into port because there's so many seriously ill people. The only way to avoid it is, frankly, to avoid a cruise ship.
Yeah.
There's no way to avoid it short of that. I mean, when the virus is there, it's there, and it seems like people get it. Good hand washing? Yeah. You know, that decreases. That always decreases things. Using the hand sanitizer, does it work? Yes. Definitely works. Helps decreasing things, but it doesn't stop it completely. I think what's important on a cruise ship is, number one, you want to take something for motion sickness. It might be a scopolamine patch, or, you know, it might be some meclizine under the name of
body. That's not going to help with the Norwalk.
That's not going to help with the Norwalk virus. You want to take something in case you get gastroenteritis on the ship. But the Norwalk virus, avoid the cruise, and that's about the only thing you can do.
Unfortunately, Zorba's advice doesn't come in patch form, so get your questions in before you depart during our next edition of Traveling Tips from Zorba. Just send your traveling question in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up, lots more of your calls, another interesting topic to talk over, and our medical myth buster. Great reasons for you to stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Callers waiting, a line is open for you at 1-800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, our recipe, this one for asparagus salad with crab.
Now, do you like asparagus?
Yeah, I love asparagus.
I had an asparagus patch years ago when I first moved into our house. We've been in our house for 30-some years. And I had 50 plants, and at their height, they produced about 40 to 50 pounds of asparagus.
Oh, my.
It was wonderful. And then I planted trees because I love trees, and as the trees grew, the asparagus...
Yeah, the asparagus went.
That was it. Yeah. That was it. And now I buy it from my local neighbor who has asparagus. Do you like crab?
I'm okay with crab.
I love crab. I just love crab. And the type of crab used in this particular recipe is really critical. Mm-hmm. Crab is not cheap. I mean, you can buy crab in those little tins next to the tuna, and that's not very good.
Right.
It's not good crab. What you want to buy if you buy crab is you either want to go to a seafood store, which is expensive, or you want to go to another store, such as Trader Joe's. In the stores I go to, and they have tins of crab that often cost $10. So it's an expensive, sort of an expensive
dish. Well,
how's that
different than the other can?
It tastes really good, and it's been refrigerated the whole time. It hasn't been cooked like the canned crab.
Okay,
so when you're going to use something like this, which is going to be a special treat because it's $10 for a tin. It's a pretty good sized tin, but it's $10. You want to use good crab. If you're going to have asparagus and you're going to have crab, you want to have it taste good. So this is not a cheap recipe. On the other hand, this is a really, really, really good recipe.
Okay, well, let's put it together.
And good for the summer. Start out with 2 pounds of fresh asparagus.
2 pounds of fresh asparagus.
That's right. You cannot do this without fresh asparagus.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't work.
All right.
You know, fresh asparagus. Yeah. If you notice how there's asparagus, it's in the marketplace a little bit longer than it used to be. Have you noticed when you go shopping for groceries, that my mother used to say, that asparagus seems to be there.
I've timed that out and find
Yeah, you timed that out. That's right.
Yeah.
Tom has his calendars, his asparagus.
Right.
3/4 cup of chives. So you're going to go get some chives.
3/4 cup of chives.
That's right. And if you don't have chives, you could use green onions, but chives have that aromatic flavor that's so much better.
Yeah.
They're in the same family, of course, as green onions. 3 navel oranges peeled and separated.
Oh, my. 3 navel oranges peeled and separated.
Now, a few things there. You could use clementines if you wanted to instead of navel oranges.
Mm-hmm.
You could use mandarin oranges.
Mm-hmm.
But my question to you is, where do you think the name navel came from?
It has a little thing on it.
What,
like a navel.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
That what it is?
Yeah.
Really? It's got that little thing
like
a navel.
Like a belly button.
Now, my question is, were we named after the orange, or was the orange named after?
The orange was named after, because who did the naming?
That's right. Who did the naming?
The orange didn't do the naming.
Mom did the naming.
Okay.
Mom did the naming. So, Mom, what do you think? I was thinking the other day, where do you think navel came from? I mean, there must...
I bet
we'll find out.
That's it. Yeah.
It came from here.
Yes.
That's where it started.
Yes, because it has that little thing that looks like...
That's right. Just like a navel.
Yeah.
But it sounds like Navy. That's right. Well, let's move on to the off the words. 14 ounces of crab meat.
14 ounces of crab meat.
Like I said, good crab meat.
Yeah.
If you go cheap on this, it's not going to stay the same.
Mm-hmm.
3 tablespoonfuls of orange juice.
Three big tea orange juice.
2 tablespoonfuls of sugar.
2 big tea sugar.
2 tablespoonfuls of white vinegar.
2 big tea white vinegar.
Now, it's important that it be white vinegar. If it's balsamic, it's going to be sweet. Balsamic actually has some calories in it, and it's sweet.
Mm-hmm.
If it's, it could be apple cider vinegar, that would be okay, but it'll add a slight pungent odor to it. White vinegar is going to be neutral.
Mm-hmm.
A teaspoon of grated or zested orange peel.
A little tea, grated orange peel.
That's right. 1/4 cup of Dijon mustard.
quarter cup Dijon mustard.
That's right. And some salt and pepper to taste.
S&P.
That's right. So boil the asparagus in a large pot of salted water until crisp. Now, you could also steam it if you want to. That's probably what I would do. Mm-hmm. And you could also microwave it according to instructions. Now, when I microwave vegetables, I always have to look up how many minutes. I'm sure it's the same for you in your house, right?
Yeah.
That's right. Don't you, whenever you microwave vegetables.
Every time.
Don't you
every
have
single
to,
time. That's right.
Yeah. You look it up. Yeah. Remove the tips and about 6 inches of the stem. Set that aside. Then dice the remaining stems into bite-sized rounds. It's about a quarter of an inch thick. Transfer the pieces to a bowl and mix in a half cup of chives and then mix in the orange slices. Then gently mix in the crab meat. Season it to taste with salt and pepper. Then in a separate medium bowl, whisk together the orange juice, sugar, vinegar, and orange peel until the sugar dissolves. Fold in the mustard. Whisk it a little bit further and then season the dressing if you need a little salt and pepper. Then divide the asparagus stems onto the plates. Evenly mound a portion of the crab meat mixture on top of the spears and then drizzle the plate with the dressing on top of that and the remaining chives on top of that and enjoy. It's wonderful.
Sounds delicious.
It's a wonderful dish. And the put together for the dish doesn't take that long. The prep time for this is really not that long at all. It's kind of a wonderful summery dish to have or spring dish. It's a wonderful dish if you want it to feel like summer to have. It's a great dish.
I would think you could call it asparagus and orange salad with crab because I would imagine the orange taste would be predominant.
I think you're right. You could definitely do that. The orange taste is going to be predominant, and of course it's going to be balanced by the vinegar taste that's in there. That'll balance. Yeah. So you've got
this
a little bit of sweet.
Delicious.
It's a really good recipe. I think you'll like it. So if you want a copy of today's recipe, you can visit us on our website at zorbapastor.org. And while you're there, you can hunt through our archives and find your favorite Zorba Pastor On Your Health recipes. You can sign up for our podcast. And, don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
Our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. To a listener now, Zorba, in Harrisburg, Kentucky. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, this is probably an unusual question, but it is health-related nonetheless. My husband and I have a small farm that we spend our summers on, and we grow all of our vegetables, and we raise some chickens that we enjoy all year long. There's a well on our property. I use it to water the livestock, and usually I water my herbs with it. And when we have chicken killing day, we chill the meat in the pump water to bring down the temperature before we process the meat to go in the freezer or go into sausage or whatever it is we're going to do with it. All of this is to lead up to say we just had the water in the well tested, and it came back with some E. coli bacteria in it and some chloroform bacteria in it. And now we've got 22 chickens in the freezer that we're concerned about. We've been doing this for 25 years, but now we've just discovered that there are these pathogens in the water that we've used to soak the chickens.
I wouldn't be concerned.
No?
And I'll tell you why. We know that chickens always have a risk of salmonella. So the chicken has to be cooked to the appropriate internal temperature. If I remember correctly, it's 185 degrees, but I never trust that. I go on the web and I always look it up if I'm going to use a thermometer to look at things. That'll kill everything. That's basically what it'll do. It'll kill the salmonella. It'll kill the E. coli that may be there. The chances of the chickens having salmonella in them, because they're kind of endemic in chickens, are actually far greater than the chances that the E. coli would be disturbing it. Nobody eats raw chicken. Anyone who does eat raw, you know, decides to eat raw chicken is sort of taking that into their own hands. Yeah. So you don't really, in all seriousness, you don't have to be concerned. You know, I'm not sure how it was in the well water. I mean, I know how it was in the well water, but I'm not sure exactly to what extent. But because you are cooking the chicken, you will be destroying any bacteria that are there. And the endemic bacteria that are in the chickens themselves, in the meat, are going to be there regardless of that. And I happen to love chicken, and I know chicken has salmonella. So when I cut chicken on a board, I'm going to wash the board, but it doesn't stop me from eating the chicken. It's not a sterile product. Food is not a sterile product ever. There is no such thing as sterile food unless you go through a process of actually sterilizing, unless you eat canned beans. I mean, canned beans are probably as close to sterile as you can. But when you eat something such as chicken that's been frozen, it's not sterile.
Yeah. So
you just have to cook it.
Is that bad water, Zorba, to give to other livestock?
Well, the livestock issue is one issue. The human issue is something else. What do they recommend for the well water? Do they say it was drinkable or not drinkable?
Well, no, and we don't drink it. We have a cistern, so we're drinking rainwater that's been filtered 2 times.
Okay, so as long as you're not drinking the water, whether or not it's okay for well water or not, you have to check with your local farm bureau. I can't answer that question. I'm not a veterinarian. I've got a lot of hats, but a veterinarianism is not one of them. But once again, it's not going to be a problem with the chickens because you've got to, you have to cook them to 185 degrees. And one of the things that I think I would pay attention to just with these chickens is the fact that I would use an internal, what I call an instant thermometer, or other people call it a microwave thermometer, and I just make sure that the chickens were totally cooked.
Yeah, I'm pretty severe about cooking my chicken all the way because I don't like pink.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is the other part of the organic movement, not specifically with chickens, but when we deal with organicism, if you will, as an umbrella, we deal with the fact that our food is not necessarily sterile. It's not sterilized by chemicals and pesticides and things of that nature. And as a result, we may have more bacteria and other things within them. And it's not that it's a downside. It's just the other side of this. We have chemicals on one side and radiation that may kill E. coli. And on the other side, we have chickens such as yours that you're making on the farm, and the other side with bacteria. And they both carry risks and benefits. And it's a matter of attending to them.
We've always thought that a little bit of dirt is a good thing.
Right.
It's sort of like how dirt is.
No, you are correct. A little bit of dirt is a good thing, and a little bit of E. coli is a good thing dead. That's what I would say.
Thank you very much. It set my mind at ease.
Great. Thank you so much for the call. 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, before we get to our break, it's time for a brief edition of Disagreeing with the Doc, or perhaps in this case, gently alerting the doc. This email from our Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox is from Barb, who writes to say, I frequently listen to and enjoy Dr. Zorba's show. However, there's one thing I've heard him say on more than one occasion that I feel compelled to bring to his attention. People no longer receive workman's compensation. It is now referred to as workers' compensation.
Well, that's interesting. She may refer. Is this a she, by the way?
Yes, Barb.
Oh, this is she. She may call it workers' compensation, but a lot of people still call it workman's compensation. Yeah. That's what they do.
But according to Barb, and I trust her, she's right and you're wrong.
We know that workers' compensation is the PC way.
I'm not sure.
And actually, officially, it may be called workers'
compensation. I was going to say, do we know whether that's been changed officially or not? We're going to find out, of course.
Oh, yes, we will. Officially, it may be called workers' compensation. Yeah. And that probably is. And that's, of course, the correct way to do it.
So what the end of conversation?
End of conversation.
Ifs, ands, or buts.
But we're talking about what's in the vernacular. What are they using? Offices. All right, I stand corrected.
If you have a rebuttal, send it in for our next edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have more calls coming up. We have some more interesting research to talk over and our medical myth buster. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 800 462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, an interesting topic to talk about.
Yes, low-salt diets. You know, these are, well, they're not really the rage, but you're often told by your doctor you should cut down on salt. But
right.
But some people are told to really cut down on salt. These are people often with heart failure, end phase, congestive heart failure, where sodium really makes a difference. It keeps the fluid on the body. It's not healthy. And they're told to cut down on salt and to use a salt substitute.
Yeah.
Now, some salt substitutes are simply made up of other herbs and spices, and they can taste quite good. Many of them have potassium in them. Potassium salt, which tastes a little bit like sodium salt, which is typical table salt, but has a slightly bitter taste to it. So it's often masked with herbs and spices and other salts. And the problem is, this is a particular study that was published in the British Medical Journal, is that some people with high potassium levels, not sodium levels, but potassium levels, were getting them from overdoing the sodium substitute, potassium salts.
Well, is it bad to have high potassium?
Absolutely. Level? High potassium can kill you. When your potassium level is high, a number of 7 or 8, it can often lead to a cardiac rhythm disturbance where all of a sudden your heart starts to go to a whole rhythm problem. You can actually go into ventricular fibrillation, and you can die from it.
But isn't there potassium in some of our foods?
Absolutely. And potassium in foods turn out to be okay. Bananas have potassium. A lot of fruits and vegetables, bananas we know are high in potassium. And taking one, you know, over-the-counter or two over-the-counter potassium tablets are okay. But this particular study shows that sometimes the salt substitutes can actually carry risks themselves, so that when a physician says, well, go, or a nutritionist, go on a very low-sodium diet, people start to use potassium, and that's bad. But it may be that other people are not just using potassium on their food, but are also taking potassium tablets. And once again, this can lead to hyperkalemia, which is what it's called, and an elevated potassium.
Well, do I have to worry about potassium by eating bananas?
No, not at all, not at all. But there's a rage within alternative medicine at this particular time in that people should be taking more potassium, because we know that in moderate amounts, potassium may lower blood pressure. And so in our typical American way, a lot of people are pouring the potassium on their food and using potassium salts when they don't really have to. They don't have congestive heart failure.
And it could harm them.
That's exactly right. There's a potential risk for hyperkalemia or elevated potassium. So I have a recommendation. Potassium in food is awesome because Mother Nature is great. But if you're going to use a potassium salt on your food, be careful and get tested.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. A listener now, Zorba, in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi.
How are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, when I was younger, I guess probably about 8 or 9, I was diagnosed with ADHD. And at the time, I'm 44 now, so at the time, there really wasn't a whole lot known to the general doctor front that I guess I was exposed to. And they just kind of put you off as a bad kid at that point. But through the years, I have learned to function by non-medicinal ways, very mild meditation and watching my diet. And to be honest with you, I'm just getting to the point now where I'm just kind of tired of doing all that, and I'm exploring different medicines that I might be able to use to control it. Fortunately for me, I'm lazy. I just have ADD now. But I was wondering your opinions on what kind of medicines I can ask my doctor to medicate for this.
Yeah, before Zorba answers, Zorba, question from me. What's the difference between ADHD and ADD?
Well, ADHD is attention deficit disorder with hyperactivity. And kids, you know, with hyperactivity, when they're in the office, they're kind of off the wall moving around. You don't see that with adults very much. You ever see adults off the wall moving around?
Jiggling around.
Yeah. You know, you're sitting in a room and adults like getting up, going down, going
racing
back and
around
forth.
The room.
Right?
Yeah, I mean,
picture
that
racing around.
It doesn't tend to happen very much.
It doesn't tend to happen.
Yeah.
So the hyperactivity tends to disappear, but the distraction and the attention deficit disorder might be there. So, what do you do for a living?
I'm a truck driver.
You find it difficult to concentrate on the road?
No, not on my job. Actually, really, this is the only job I've ever had that I can function at 100% because things are changing, you know, every second. It's whenever I get off the road, all the paperwork that I have to do. Through the years, I've had multiple jobs that I just couldn't keep it because of the attention deficit.
Well, let me give a recommendation. First of all, there are a lot of adults who still have ADD. Not all of them. In other words, you
don't
have it as a child.
You don't hear about that very often.
It's no, you don't, but you hear about it more and more. You hear a lot about with kids. And what happens is most kids over time, as they become adults, grow out of it. Adults often learn how to handle that. It seems to change. But about a quarter to a third, depending on who you read, continue into adulthood. And then adults who have it often have to find a job that fits what they can do. And you've noticed it. It's very typical right away. You're in a truck. You're in your rig. You have to pay attention all the time because if you don't pay attention, you're going to get into an accident. Yeah. But when you're sitting with a piece of paper, you don't have to pay attention, although you do, and you've got to force yourself into that, and that's really where it fits. And the drugs that work are stimulants. Things such as methylphenidate, which is Ritalin or Concerta, typical drug that's used. Amphetamines are used, such as dextroamphetamine. Adderall happens to be a combination of amphetamine salts that is also used. And then there are a few other drugs. There's a drug made by Eli Lilly and so on that also can be very useful. But what you have to do is you have to find a physician in your area who treats ADHD or ADD, either one of them, and is willing then to prescribe these drugs because these drugs are controlled substances. They can be drugs of abuse. Methylphenidate, not as much, but when you look at the amphetamine salts, they're controlled. Both of these are controlled substances because they were speed. That's what they are. They're speed in a different variation, but they can be very, very useful. You've got to pick the right office to go to. There are some offices that are, frankly, they're drug mills. And many of these occur in Florida. Florida has the biggest problem in the country with drug mill offices where physicians are really not interested in your ADD. They're interested in having you come once a month, getting, you know, you get your prescription, they get their fee, and it's slam, bam, thank you, ma'am. I mean, it's an awful, awful situation. You don't want an office like this. You want to talk to your family doctor or, you know, your regular doctor and say, look, I feel I have ADD. I'd like, if you want me to be tested at a neuropsych testing clinic, send me there and I'll be tested. Let's identify this, and I want to find out whether or not you'd be willing to prescribe this medication. And that's what you want. You don't want to go to a drug mill doctor to get your drugs because, frankly, you're not going to be treated well.
Okay, my last question about that is all the drugs that you just said, which I had a heck of a time trying to write down because you talk like an auctioneer sometimes. I'm curious if any of those would. Am I allowed to drive heavy machinery while I'm taking those?
Well, they don't make you sleepy. That's number one. It's the drugs that are sleepy. They're narcotics that you're not allowed to drive with. But my thought is that you wouldn't use this drug when you were driving. You would use the drug when you're doing paperwork. That's exactly when I would use it. You don't have trouble when you're driving. Don't use it then. You're on the road. You're on the rig. You don't need it. What you need is immediate release Ritalin, generic, to use when you have to concentrate on your paperwork. Now, you have to check your state regulations to find out in each individual state whether it is. I'm not sure about the federal regulations, but they generally have to do with narcotics. But you can find out from the work that you do, or you can go online to see whether or not it's disallowed drug. That I don't know.
You rock. Thank you so much, Doc. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for the call. We appreciate that. And Zorba, time once again now for our medical myth buster. Today's myth may be appropriate because it deals with air conditioning. While it is nearly a necessity on hot days, is it true that air conditioning causes colds?
Well, the answer is maybe. It's in the maybe realm. It's either yes or no, and I'll tell you why. The cold air does not cause colds. Doesn't cause colds. I mean, yeah. We have cold air in the winter, and we have more colds in the winter, but that's because we're in closer quarters. There are viruses, and you know, you sneeze, and I'm breathing in, and I catch it, or it's on my hands, and we shake hands, and you know, you've got mucus around. I mean, as soon as people go indoors, the virus is spread. I mean, that's what it is. It's a herding problem. You know, we're herding heating because we're indoors. But what air conditioning does do is it dries out the air. So you're going from a humid, moist air in many cases, not in all cases, to a dry air. That's if they're in humid areas. Of course, if you're in the Southwest, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. So it might be the dryness caused by the air conditioning might actually make a slight, you know, may increase it slightly.
Why would dryness cause colds?
Because we often have to have a certain amount of moisture in our nose to keep our nose functioning properly. When it doesn't function properly, the virus can come in there and kind of hang out and do its dirty deeds.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really what it is. So there may be a little bit. You know, the studies have never bore that out. And people are shocked when they get a cold in the summer. They'll say, why am I getting cold in the summer? I'm supposed to get a cold in the winter. Well, the answer is there are viruses in the summer, but people are often outdoors in the summer, so they don't get them as often.
Yeah, interesting. Well, freeze out your myth by sending it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Again, 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a caller now in Dayton, Ohio. Hi.
Hi, Zorba and Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
We appreciate it. How can we help you?
Well, I am having a problem with my energy levels, and I'm thinking about going on a detox diet to try to reboot my system. Just to give you a real brief background, I'm 49 years old. I had good health until my early 30s when I got hypothyroidism. And my energy levels were never back up to normal. I had sleep apnea, but I lost a lot of weight. So that's not it. And I'm wondering if these detox diets, if they do what they're supposed to do, that is, they get your energy level back up, and are they safe, and are they effective?
Well, help me out. What is a detox diet?
It's an excellent question, and, you know, I don't really know. I'm reading a book right now where basically they talk about going on a 7-day diet where you're eating very low calories, taking a lot of tea in, various supplements, and the idea is, and they use a lot of buzzwords, you know, you eat foods that support your liver function, cleanse your system, and, you know, it sounds reasonable, but I don't know if it's scientific or even safe.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, detox diets are not new. They're old. People often fast. You know, they fast for health, and they may fast in a variety of ways. Those are very traditional diets. They're traditional in a lot of different cultural systems, you know, to, quote, give your gut a chance, give it a break to sort of, detox the food.
Well, is that all it means is fast?
Well, no. But for some people, detox diet may be eating certain foods, drinking certain liquids. There are whole variations. But it basically means a denial of an omnivorous diet. That's usually what it is. In other words, it's not eating what you usually eat. It's eating something that is special and different. And if you look at complementary and alternative medicine as a group, there are a lot of different detox diets on there. And people say, look, I take this diet. I'm on there for, you know, once a month or once every 2 months, and I feel like I have more energy afterwards.
So it's depriving yourself of things you like and eating things you don't like.
Yeah, basically, that's exactly what it is. It's sort of the – that's exactly – yes. No one goes on a diet where it's the chocolate diet. That's never the detox diet. I'm going to have all the chocolate, all the candy, all the dessert. Although, frankly, I think that should be my next book. The chocolate, candy, dessert, detox your diet. Give yourself everything you want to eat and, you know, while you're good health. Now, are they selling anything in this book, by the way? Is there anything?
No, they aren't. It's
okay.
It's a 7-day, and they actually give a regimen of, you know, what you eat. So it's like water, lemon water, herbal tea.
I think that what happens are, first of all, our liver takes care of itself. Liver takes care of itself. Most people, when they die in this country, do not die of liver failure. The liver works just fine. 88, 90 years of age, they die of a heart attack. Liver is okay. And they've never been on a detox diet. So the liver is a wonderful organ, does a lot of good things. Colon, great thing, the colon. It's got lots of bacteria, lots of viruses in there. It makes vitamin K for us. It cleanses us. It gets rid of water in the system. Colon is wonderful. It has some polyp problems. They're taken care of, you know, and cancer problems. We don't know what causes colon cancer. We do know that a high fiber diet tends to be, reduce colon cancer, and it has some of its own problems. But for most people, colon is just fine. So, you know, but people have this idea that we have to get rid of the things because the organs themselves don't do it. I think Mother Nature works just beautifully, and I think that trying a detox diet to see if you have more energy is really a separate issue because some people swear by it. They'll say, I go on a 3-day detox diet and I've got energy for the next month. And I know that we don't have a good handle on why some days we're energetic and some days we're not. I'm sure you've experienced that, right? Where some days you're on task and other days you're not, and there's been no difference that you can possibly see. So I think a diet for that is good. But the biology that's often in the diet cleansing books is pseudoscience. They give you a little bit of science and then a lot of dreamy states.
So try it, and if it works, that's...
Try it. If you feel better, then it's useful. But as far as actually any evidence that your colon and liver need help, I don't think it's there.
And since I'm eating all the things I don't like, which are good things, I should be fine.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Deny thyself and you will live longer. But then it won't be nearly as sweet a life.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for your help.
Thank you very much for the call. And before we leave for the week, Zorba, let's share an amusing anecdote from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This comes to us from a listener named Steve, who literally shares your pain.
Oh, I love it. I love it. He feels my pain.
Yeah, there you go. Steve writes, I was listening to your program and recipe on turkey rolls, and it made me laugh. Your comment concerning washing your hands after cleaning the jalapenos struck close to home. About 5 years ago, I cleaned about a dozen habaneras from my garden and then went to urinate. Then came back to the kitchen to finish my food prep. I did wash my hands after doing my business. Within about 3 minutes, it felt like I came down with an instant urinary tract infection or spontaneous STD. Fortunately or unfortunately, my wife wasn't home to see my Mexican dance of death gripping my groin. Dr. Pastor, I can speak from experience. You gave good advice. I am a medical provider that also learned the hard way.
I feel your pain.
Even if your lifestyle problem is self-inflicted, we want to help you. Just send your questions to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. And if you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Executive producer Adam Friedrich and technical director Brad Kohlberg, the Vincent Chase and Johnny Drama of WPR, are the two guys responsible for this hour. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0806Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.